The Joint Conference Committee on Higher Education will come to order. A quorum will be present once Senator Putnam comes to his seat. thank you all so much. We will start by adopting the sames and similars that we discussed yesterday. We will go through a series of motions for each one. And members, please feel free to jump in or interrupt if you have any questions or need any clarifications as we go through each one. First up, we'll go through R3132, lines 23.22 and 24.26 of the House bill, and lines 2915 through 30.19 of the Senate bill. Is there a motion to adopt this language?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just note that this is the cybersecurity addition for the doctoral degree to the Minn State program is something that we've discussed at great length and we're very supportive of on the House side. And if that's a different answer, then my co-chair will correct me. But I believe we are all on board with this. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chair Rarick. Move to adopt the language. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Next up, we'll move language on R52 through 53, which is the North Star Promise definitions, House lines 3419 through 3513, and Senate lines 4922 through 5017. Is there a motion? Chair Rarick.
Mr. Chair, what page are you on of the same as?
Page
four of the spreadsheet.
Mr. Chair, can you repeat the sections you're talking about?
It is R52 through 53. It is going to be House lines 3419 through 3513 and Senate lines 4922 through 5017. It's the North Star Promise definitions section.
Yep. I'll move that motion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Rarick moves. All those in favor say aye. Oh, sorry, any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion is, the motion prevails. Next up, we'll move language on R53 through 54, House lines 3521 through 3616. And Senate lines 5023 through 5117. This is the North Star Promise conditions for eligibility. Is there a motion?
I'll make a motion, Mr. Chair.
Chair Rarick moves R53 to 54. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'll explain what it is.
Chair Rarick, yes.
Thank you. So really quickly, this is what we had agreed upon, that if you've already received your first baccalaureate degree, then you're no longer eligible for North Star Promise, and I believe that was something that we both agreed to make sure that we uphold the integrity of the program. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails. Next up, R54, the self-loans additional institution eligibility requirements. This removes a requirement that OHE determines whether institutions in another state maintain certain academic standards. This is going to be on House lines 3616 through 23 and Senate lines 5118 through 25. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll make that motion.
Thank you. Chair Rarick moves R54. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. Next, we have R54 through 55, the self-loans and classification of data. This removes OHE's, the number of late payments in the previous 12 months, quote, from the list of data elements that OHE may disclose to a consumer credit reporting agency with borrower consent. This is going to be House lines 3624 through 3715 and Senate lines 5126 through 5118. Is there a motion?
Make that motion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Rarick makes the motion. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So again, this is something that we did discuss in committee, and Chair Scott actually looked at this. She is our data hawk, and so it is just a duplicative report that they're condensing together, consolidating together.
Thank you so much. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. So next up will be the dual training on R56 through 57. And what this is these are two sections that amend a definition to specify that certificates, diplomas, or degrees earned under the program must come from an accredited post-secondary institution. I believe we have the A12 amendment. Would Ohi like to come up and speak to this as well? Oh, is it A14?
This one is the A12.
It's A12.
The A14 is for the private.
I'm sorry, can we get the amendments passed out as well? We'll pause a moment. Thank you.
Those are different.
Oh, there's one's the A12?
One's a 12 and one's a 14.
Oh, one's a 12, one's a 14.
Okay.
Can a representative from OHI please come up to speak on this? To the A12 amendment. And underlying language. Welcome, Ms. Oliver. Please introduce yourself for the record and you may proceed.
Thank you. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Community Engagement for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and I believe the amendment in front of you removes all added accredited that was added to sections of the dual training grants. We only intended to add accredited to certificates and degrees in the program. To make it specified that we are providing the program to qualified accredited degrees and certificates. That was the intention, not to eliminate eligibility of specific training programs. So that is what the amendment is doing. It's making a correction.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver. Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Oliver, I was just wondering, what if we had kept this language in, what are some examples of training programs that would have been eliminated? And I know there are probably a lot of them. This was something that's very near and dear to my heart that I put this into law about 10 years ago. So I appreciate you coming and always making it better.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Oliver.
Thank you. And Chair Rarick, I believe DLI gave an example of like an IT program. I don't have the specific names of programs. They did mention like specifically IT training certificate programs might have been eliminated, but they did say a significant number of the training providers would have been eliminated if we kept accredited the way it was added in the statutes here. We didn't intend to add it. I think it was a copy error when we were adding creating the different bills here. I think our original proposal just added it in the one section that we're correcting here.
Thank you.
Our
members, is there any other members that would like to speak to this or questions for Ms. Oliver? Are members comfortable with adopting the underlying amendment? Awesome. Chair Rarick.
I was just going to move the A12.
So thank you.
As we've discussed it, and then move its adoption.
Awesome. Chair Rarick moves the A12 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, The amendment is adopted. Now to the identified language as amended. Any other comments or questions before we move? So Chair Rarick, would you like to move?
Mr. Chair, I'll move that section, the R5657 section.
Thank you so much. Chair Rarick moves the R5657 portion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion is adopted. Next, we have R58 through 63, the Private and Out-of-State and Post-Secondary Act. These sections make OHE's recommended changes to the Private and Out-of-State Public Post-Secondary Education Act, which includes increases in certain fees. With that, I believe we have also the A14 amendment. I apologize, we don't have the A14 amendment. That's for the next one. So are there any questions or comments on this section?
Mr. Chair.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in my notes, I have a recommendation to adopt the the House language as are slightly different. And so I would just move that forward. I believe both nonpartisan House and Senate have conferred.
Thank you so much, Chair Rarick. Is there a motion to move House language on lines 4260 through 46.7?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. Next up, we have finally R63 through 73, which is also House language, the Private Career School Act. Again, there are slight technical differences, and there's a recommendation to adopt the House language on lines 46.8 through 58.9. We have the A14 amendment. Would anyone like to move the A14 amendment, or would we'd like to come up and speak to the amendment as well?
So, Chair, I'll move the amendment so we can have a conversation.
Thank you. Chair Rarick moves the amendment. Welcome.
Good
Please
afternoon.
Introduce yourself
Andrew
for the
Wald
record.
With the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. So this amendment does a couple things. First, it has some language that is being removed from the private career school definition to remove some circularity because exempt institutions shouldn't be removed from the definition. They are exempt private career schools. They receive exemptions from certain portions of the statute. If they were removed from the definition of a private career school, then none of the act would apply to them. Since we are changing around a lot of the definitions of what a private career school is, we want to keep exempt institutions within the framework of the act and just exempt them specifically from the certain provisions. That is line 1.3 of the amendment. Lines 1.5 through 1.8 strike the requirement for applicants for a limited license to pay a fee of $1,500 if they are seeking limited license only for the purposes of obtaining a dual training grant or being eligible training providers on the eligible training provider list and accessing WIOA funds. Lines 1.9 through 1.12 on the amendment do the same thing for renewal fees. Those were not intended to be institutions that paid that fee. Mea culpa there. I thought that had been removed in a prior phase, but it's important that they be removed now because they would be prohibitive for some institutions to obtain that financial aid, dual training grant, or being able to access the ETPL, and it would raise fees for our unit exorbitantly and in unintended ways. So we want that taken out so that we can do right by institutions in that way.
Are there any other questions before we adopt the amendment? With none, Chair Rarick moved. Go ahead. I think you already moved it, right?
Mr. Chair, I did move it. I was just going to say that I did put this language into the side-by-side, okay. And I concur. It's a good amendment, and I am very glad that we're again holding harmless the dual training program in the best way we possibly can. So thank you. So that's not cost prohibitive for those that want to participate.
Thank you. Chair Rarick moves the A14 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Now we're on the identified language as amendment, as amended. Are there any other questions? Is there a motion?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Chair Rarick moves R63 through 73 as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. Members, that concludes our same and similar language that was just been adopted. Further adoption of the language will be discussed in future hearings. We will now proceed to the discussion about policy differences between the two bills. This is intended to be an informal opportunity to share information and ask questions for each bill. We will not be moving any adoption of any language today, but I will note that we will plan to take up a more detailed discussion of the state grant and the sexual misconduct policy differences on a Monday when Chair Walgamott has the gavel in order to have the right subject matter experts from OHI in the room. So we'll be skipping those today. So the Senate does have a bit more time to consider policy provisions this year, so we've added a document in member packets that summarize the policy provisions from the standalone Senate bills to make it easier to follow along. So members, please feel free to call up anyone from the public at any time for questions at any point. And with that, we'll start with the first item on the list, which is R5 through 6 and Article 1. R5 through 6 is the emergency grants. The Senate and House both have changed the way funds from the existing emergency grant program are allocated. So rather than having funds flow through OHI, both bills directly appropriate funding for emergency grants to the University of Minnesota and to MinnState. While this is a finance provision, we are focused today on how the funds are distributed rather than the levels of funding, since we don't have any joint targets yet. In the Senate bill, we add some stricter reporting requirements to ensure more transparency and give the legislator greater oversight of funds. We also retain funding for OHI's existing competitive grant program to allow private and tribal colleges to continue access to funds. And to me, this was important to continue funding for private and tribal colleges because we know that all students have emergencies and deserve to have the support they need when they need it most, regardless of the institution they attend. So Senator Duckworth is not here right now, but he likes to say that in our committee, a student is a student is a student. And that's something that we honor. And I know he shares our position that we should allow private and tribal colleges to access these funds. I'll pass it off to Chair Rarick or Chair Walgamott. Would you like to speak on the House positions on the emergency grants?
Mr. Chair, I believe I'm being deferred to, so. We did something similar. We wanted to have, instead of OHI have to administrate it so much, to just send it directly to the systems. We should probably talk a little bit about how we did it with the tribal colleges. Hopefully we'll get a hold of the tribal colleges and someone will come on Monday so we can talk to them about if they want that money kind of rolled up into O&M or if they want it separate, if they have the ability to do that. The one thing that we did do, which we can have that conversation too, is that we did exclude the private colleges from this. It was a small amount of money, but we can certainly talk about reincorporating that like the Senate did. So that's essentially, and then you have reporting, which we didn't talk about, but I would like to hear more about what it is that you're asking in the reporting, if you could let us know what that is.
I can call up OHI for reporting. A representative from OHI, please come up. Sorry. Welcome, Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dennis Olson, serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education.
So, well, the question was, the Senate added some additional reporting requirement on the emergency assistance grants, and they were saying that you would be able to enlighten us as to what those changes were, what those additions were.
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Chair Rarick, is there a specific line I should be looking at in the bill just to see what's incorporated in the reporting requirements? Sorry.
It starts on line 5.25.
On
R6.
Five point two five on R6.
Page R6.
Yeah. All right. Mr. Chair, yeah, thank you. I don't see any significant issues with that additional reporting requirement. On behalf of the agency, it is, you know, additional administrative function. It's time, but it's something, if it's valuable to the committee and to the legislature as a whole, we're okay with it.
Thank you, Commissioner. And some of the idea was just to provide greater transparency over the funds. So that's one of the discussions we had with both members, or all members in the committee. Chair Rarick.
Thank you. It's okay, Chair. So I was just wondering, what are some of the main things that you're asking for in the report? Senator Fattah?
Ms. Bursch.
Chair Fattah, Chair Rarick. The new reporting requirement for the emergency assistance for post-secondary students grant program would require OHE to report on how money was distributed among the institutions, how students apply for the grants, and institutions determine who gets the awards and how much. How many students received awards, the most common student needs that grants were awarded to meet, and the average length of time between when a grant was requested and when funds were dispersed to a student.
Thank you, Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you have is there a limit in the new language or in the underlying language as to how many times a student can apply for an emergency grant? I know that was a discussion from the House.
No.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I may, regarding the question about the elements, those are questions to the comment we just heard, those are questions we typically request of the participating institutions anyway, and in turn roll it up into a report to the legislature. So.
Awesome. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I appreciate the language that the Senate has added, and I agree with the comments you attributed to Senator Duckworth that a student is a student is a student. So I would personally support the Senate position on this. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative. Next up, I'd like to ask representatives from the U and Mint State to come up and briefly talk to us about how they would be impacted by a shift in direct appropriations from this program. I'd also like to ask a representative from the private colleges to also come up and tell us how these funds have been previously utilized by private colleges and students. So if we can have a representative from in-state, the U, and the private colleges to come up. I see Paul coming up right now. Thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you may begin.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Paul Cirkvenik, president of the Private College Council. I cannot give you detailed information about how the funds are distributed at the institutional level, but I would be glad to ask the institutions to share some of that information back with us. These grants, as I understand in the past, institutions have applied to the Office of Higher Education. They've received the grants, and then they use the grants in accordance with the agency's rules and requirements. But we would be glad to ask institutions what they're doing with the dollars.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions for Mr. Cirkvenik before we move on? Thank you so much. Thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourselves for the record, and you may begin.
Good afternoon, Chairs Walgamat, Fateh, and Rarik. My name is Colleen McDonald. I am the Executive Director and Assistant Vice Provost of Boynton Health and responsible for basic needs on campus, on the Twin Cities campus.
Yep. Good afternoon. I'm Michelle Trumpy, Director of Public Health at the University of Minnesota.
I'm going to speak a little bit about the emergency grants. When we were originally putting our state proposal together, we spent some time talking to all the campuses about the challenges students have accessing emergency grants and how important they are. And these emergency grants cover things like getting your driver's license, transportation, emergency housing, as well as other needs. And this was definitely a part of the proposal that was really critically needed by all outstate campuses as well as the Twin Cities. Now I'm going to turn it over to Michelle Trumpy so she can speak a little bit about the Hunger Free Campus grants specifically.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity. We're here to testify in support of transitioning that from a competitive grant process into an appropriation. The number of students experiencing food insecurity across the University of Minnesota campuses is substantial and growing. Currently, one out of four students across the University of Minnesota systems are reporting that they're either worried about their food or they've actually run out of food, and we continue to grow our operations on all five of our campuses to provide that emergency food relief, and having that direct appropriation will be helpful in terms of our planning that we can just continue to offer seamless operations for our students.
Thank you so much for that. Are there any questions for our testifiers before we move on to the next section?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Oh, Bernie, yeah, Mr. Oman, are you here? Welcome.
Chair Fateh, Chair Rarik, that was really a rookie mistake on my part by standing up. Thank you for the question. We are very supportive of the language having the direct appropriation. We have a robust conversation with our campuses and our Division of Student Affairs, and this will just allow us to expedite and get the money out faster, and the accountability obviously lies in that process we currently have. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Oman? Thank you. Next up, we got R7 through 9, the Hunger-Free Campus Grants. Similar to the emergency grants program, the Senate changes the Hunger-Free Campus funding to a direct appropriation to the U and Minn State while retaining the competitive grant structure for the private and tribal colleges. Again, our intent is to reduce overhead costs, cut red tape, and get funds out the door more efficiently. We also added similar reporting language to the emergency grants program to allow for more transparency. The student organizations and the colleges asked us to make this change. And before we go to discussion, I'd like to ask if there's any members of the audience who would like to come up and speak to this change. But I also see Senator Putnam has a question.
I have a question for Minnesota State.
Yeah.
Mr.
Senator Putnam.
Mr.
Oman.
Mr. Oman could come back just for one more question, please.
Mr. Oman. Welcome, Mr. Oman. Please reintroduce yourself for the record.
Bernie Oman with Minnesota State.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Oman. This is a pretty good idea, huh?
Yeah.
Mr. Oman.
It's a great idea. Thank you,
Senator. That's all I got.
Thank you, Mr. Oman. Are there anyone else from the audience that would like to come up? I see we have members from Students United and Lead MN. If anyone would like to come up. Is there any further discussion from now? Oh, yes, thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and
thank you.
Begin.
My name is Molly Lloyds, and I am the policy director at Lead MN. So thank you, Chairs Fateh, Rarik, and Walgamat. We have been talking to the basic needs coordinators on our campuses, And I will say that on our campuses, they are not always called basic needs coordinators. It is people wearing a lot of hats and doing a lot of work, but all with the same goal of meeting students' basic needs and all with the same concerns. We hear directly from students as well. So I shared these. I think they got in late. I think I sent them to Sam. But a couple of our basic needs coordinators from Minnesota State College Southeast, which has two campuses pretty far apart. She drives her car to and from. She's also working on piloting a program based on a New York program where they can have a virtual food bank. So they're just really working with their resources. And they're all really supportive of this change. Both of these had a delay in receiving funds this year, applying in August and receiving funds in December, and are just hopeful that and express confidence in the system's ability to help streamline this and really get the heart of this bill, which is getting students fed. So I just wanted to say I'm hearing directly from people who do this work on campuses as well as students in support of that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are there any questions for our testifier? Seeing none, thank you so much. Next up, we'll go to R31, which is the direct admissions.
Mr. Chair, before you
move. Yes.
Thank you. So before you move on, I just wanted to check in with Chair Wolgamont because he cares an awful lot about the Hunger Free Campus grants, and I just wanted him to weigh in on the change that the Senate did and see what his thoughts were.
Thank you, Chair Eric. Chair Wolgamont.
Well, thank you for checking in, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Fate. I support the Senate position.
Thank you so much, Chair Wolgamont, and thank you, Chair Eric. Everyone's okay with us moving on? Awesome. We're now on Article 2, the direct admissions language on R31. The Senate requires public and charter high schools to participate in the direct admissions program by the 2029-2030 school year. Our intent here is to continue to scale up OHE's successful direct admissions program. In your packets, members, you will find OHE's 2025 report, which shows that the program continues to lead to higher FAFSA completion rates and college enrollment among recent high school graduates. This five-year runway gives OHE a runway to scale the program statewide and provide assistance to high schools to implement the program fully. This was a bipartisan bill from Senators Gustafson and Duckworth and Rep. Mueller in the House. It was supported by Ed Allies and Students United, among others. And as we go to discussion, I'm wondering if Assistant Commissioner Robinson would come up and tell us how OHE would implement the language. And we'd also like to invite any representatives from Ed Allies and Students United to also speak briefly. But Assistant Commissioner, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record. And you may begin.
Hello, for the record, my name is Wendy Robinson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Programs, Policies, and Grants here at the Office of Higher Education. And the question was, if you restate it.
How you would implement the language.
Yeah, so thank you for that question and the reminder. You know, from the beginning of the direct admissions pilot, our goal has always been to see it expanded to all high schools in the state of Minnesota. We believe, you know, when we started the program, we said it was a true pilot the first year to see if it actually did the things that we thought it was going to do. And the good news is after several years of doing it, it does appear to do a lot of really good things for our students and for our state in terms of increasing enrollment in college in the fall immediately after high school graduation, increasing FAFSA completion, and keeping more of our students here in Minnesota. And so we would love to make sure that every student has the opportunity to participate in this program. So that's always been the long-term goal, was to scale over time and to make sure that all students have that opportunity. I think having a mandatory requirement to scale, will ideally, if this moves forward, would get us to where we wanted to go anyways, but maybe just a little bit faster. And I think we are now at the point where we have enough years of doing this to kind of understand what that would look like and what that we would continue to implement it in the way that we have been so far, with additional schools coming on every year and working with those schools directly to help them make sure that this is not a overly burdensome lift on their staffing as they develop the program.
Thank you so much. Any questions for Assistant Commissioner? Chair Rerick.
Thank you for being here, Assistant Commissioner. About how many or what percentage of our schools are doing this now?
Assistant Commissioner Robertson.
Thank you for the question. So this year we expanded to 182 high schools, and we are, our goal for next year would be to be somewhere between 250 and 300 high schools. We are about at the tipping point where that's going to represent over 50% of the high school seniors in the state, however, just because of the size of some of the larger schools that we have participating now. We are not quite in every county yet, but we're getting a lot closer to that measure as well. This year we had just about around 31,000 students participating who are eligible to participate in direct admission.
Thank you. Chair Eric.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this requirement is actually extended to charter high schools as well. Are you currently working with any charter high schools?
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
For the question, we are working with any school that wishes to participate. And so we've always taken an expansive view of including public institutions, private and parochial schools that wish to participate, alternative learning centers, and charter high schools. So yes, we do have some already in the program.
Thank you. Chair Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would have some concerns with this just because we're, it's one thing to go from really large systems or medium-sized systems to the very small schools that are out in rural areas like my area, and many Republican House members have and senators have very small schools, consolidated schools. My concern, even though it's not till the 29-30 school year, that this would be difficult for them if we require all of them. So at least from the GOP House side, we would be opposing this this change. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Eric. Are there any other questions? Senator, Representative Coulter.
Not at the Senate anymore, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question here. So I see the Senate bill has a $500,000 appropriation for direct admissions in both biennia. Is that, and I don't know maybe who this is a question for, is that I presume it's sort of that is geared toward this scaling up of the direct admissions, and I guess my question is, going from close to half to everybody, I mean, that's a pretty big jump. Is that, do we think that $500,000 per biennium would be enough to accomplish that, or can you give me an idea of what the costs might look like for that?
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Thank you so much for the question. So the costs associated with this are kind of coming in a couple of different buckets. And I'll preface this by saying that when we are working directly with our schools to do direct admissions, we have schools that are as small as having 10 students in their graduating class to schools as large as having 600-700 students in their graduating class. Our approach for all of those schools has been to try to be their best partner that we can be, and to try to carry as much of the workload so that it's not overly burdensome to their high school counseling staff. We estimate that in the first year of being a direct admission school, it takes about 40 hours of work for them to stand up the program. And then each subsequent year, it drops to about 20 hours of work once they've done it and they get the muscle memory and they kind of know how that's going to go. The additional funding would be necessary for a couple of different things. One is we would have some additional staff needs within the agency, largely on the data side of it, because the way that direct admissions works is when students get their direct admissions letter, they get to make the choice to opt in and to share their information with colleges and universities of their choice. That comes through us. We make sure it's clean, we make sure it's accurate, we make sure it's protected before it goes to the higher education institutions. And so obviously doubling the volume of that means that we just need another set of eyes to make sure that we're tracking that all accordingly. We also work directly with the approved tech vendors for the K-12 education systems, and so having to do some expanded contracting with the ones who are not currently engaged in the process will take a little bit of work. And then we've also dedicated some of the funding to go to the high schools themselves to either supplement some of their staff costs. So if they wanted to, for example, have their guidance counselors come in during the summertime, get a jump start on this while they're not on contract, we can supplement their costs so they can get it done before the school year starts so it doesn't interfere with other duties, or do other college access activities. And so we'd have a little bit of additional funding for the new schools coming on board.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. That's a helpful answer. I would just say that I think I've seen the impact of this in my own community. I think Jefferson High School in Bloomington was one of the first actually to participate in the program. It's not to be totally biased, it's also where I went to high school, but it's definitely been really, really beneficial. So I do hope this is something that we can look at. Thank you.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you may begin.
OK, Casey Metcalf, Students United Government Relations. Thanks for the opportunity to speak on this. This bill is the result of a multi-year conversation about FAFSA rates in the state of Minnesota. In the past several years, Minnesota has kind of been the bottom of the barrel for FAFSA rates, around 41st, 42nd in the country, around 47%. Schools who participate in direct admissions year over year went, in 2020, a school would expect to see about a 47% FAFSA rate. By 2022, that same school would expect to be about 58% FAFSA rate, which puts them near the top of the country. I would also add that I agree that there are some concerns about equity, especially when it comes to rural communities. I worked in a school in Columbia Heights Public Schools, who, if you were in K-12, you heard a lot from Columbia Heights Public Schools on compensatory revenue. That school completes this program without any counselors in its high school. So I think that there are creative ways where schools and districts can make, small logistical changes that can make this program work in just about any district or any school. And I would also say that a five-year runway provides a long enough time for schools to make those adjustments. Students United is in full support of this, in part because now we started to see students coming up from K-12 who are now getting to use this program. In the House, we had a student from Moorhead, who's from Faribault, who went through this program and talked about the impact that it had on her. And so we ask that you include it in your final omnibus.
Thank you. Are there any questions for our testifier? Thank you so much for coming up. We have Mr. Shaver from EdAllies. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Good afternoon, Chair Rarick and Chair Fateh. I'm Matt Shaver. I'm the Senior Policy Director at EdAllies. We're K-12 advocates for kids who we support policies that improve outcomes, close achievement gaps, and opportunity and outcome gaps for traditionally marginalized kids. I spent a lot of time in my summer reading agency reports that show what a lousy job we do as a state for students of color and students in poverty for academic outcomes. I came across a report that OHE did about direct admissions and was blown away. You read enough of these reports about how many students in poverty in the state we fail to teach to read, how many students in poverty we suspend on a regular basis, how many students we fail as a system and as a group of adults. When you see outcomes like we see in the direct admissions program, you're bowled over by it. And you start asking questions, and you start thinking about why every student in the state doesn't have the same opportunity that right now about one-fourth of high schools provide for kids. And it shouldn't be based on zip code. It should be based on the opportunity and the standard that we set. The reality is that the mandate on schools right now is in 120B.125. It's a personalized learning plan that every single high school must provide for every single student, whether you're a charter high school, you're a big high school, you're a small high school, you're an urban high school, you're a rural high school, that every single year starting in ninth grade, you are required to prepare every single student for a college and career plan, and that is updated on an annual basis. Direct admissions will provide both students, families, and schools with the tools and information to successfully achieve that mandate that has been around for over a decade. The information that is provided to schools through direct admissions about where students will get in will help counselors achieve their mission, give them the tools that they succeed, give students and families the information that they know so that the doors of opportunity for post-secondary and career are wide open. It's incredibly important. The data is super promising. We picked 29, 2030 based on OHE's own report that in the next 3 to 5 years, they felt like they'd be ready to scale it up. We took the more conservative estimate, trying to be sensitive to the nature of giving as long of a runway as possible. The reality is that the mandate is already there to provide college and career services to all students, regardless of what high school you are and what corner of the state you are. Direct admissions in every high school will make sure that schools achieve that mandate that all kids deserve. So thank you.
Thank you. Senator Putnam has a question.
That's actually not a question. It's more of a follow-up. So if you like the real estate, you can stay sitting there, but you don't need to. I wanted to say that in support of Mr. Metcalf's and Mr. Shaver's comments, I texted the superintendent in St. Cloud, and surprisingly, she texted me back. And St. Cloud has, Chair Rarick's point about equity, St. Cloud is the worst funded school district in the entire state. It's official. The distance between the cost of our students and the money that we have, we are the officially worst funded school district in the state. And we have direct admissions at both of our high schools. And apparently it is not a budget line at all. in San Quentin Public Schools. So I think that there might be a space in there that's dynamic enough or flexible enough so that it works for every school.
Thank you so much, Senator Putnam. Are there any other questions before we move on? Thank you so much to our testifiers. Next up, we are on R50 disclosure of, I'm sorry, R32, opiate antagonist. This is brought by Students United, and I believe it was a Senator Weber bill. On R32 and R77, the Senate has language requiring public colleges and universities to stock 2 doses of an opiate antagonist in each residential building. We included this in the Senate position because we think that at the end of the day, it will help save lives. And I'd like to call back up Mr. Metcalf to speak on this, if possible.
Back so soon.
Yes. Welcome.
Hello again. So this campaign has been part of student senates across the state for a really long time, shouting out Mankato Student Senate in particular for the conversations that they've been having with their administration for many years about having access to Narcan on campus. It also comes pretty authentically out of Moorhead, where there are several students who talk to their administration directly about having access to Narcan on campus. In our campus visits the following year, after being told that indeed there would be access to Narcan on campus, we found that there was not. There are a lot of different, a variety of harm reduction strategies that we see on our campuses, but they vary widely. Bemidji, for example, is universal access. You can get it pretty much anywhere. Metro is similar. And then you go to Moorhead and it feels like you really struggle to find it at all. So we're supportive of this. We're supportive of having greater compliance across public university systems to save student lives, especially because the legislature has placed so much emphasis on overdose prevention in K-12.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions from members? Chair Eric.
Thank you. I would just note that we did hear this bill. It is in our health bill. And I think Chair Wolgamott wants to speak to it too. So when I get that, my question is, I'm just not remembering off the top of my head how much it costs. And I know it'll be a cost to the institutions that we'll have to, or the systems that we'll have to fund.
Ms. Bursch.
Chair Fate, Chair Rarick, a fiscal note was completed on the Senate bill as amended, and there are costs estimated to both Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota. For Minnesota State, it's $77,000 in the 26-27 biennium and $52,000 in the 28-29 biennium. And for the University of Minnesota, it is $80,000 in 26-27 and $28,000 in 28-29. So that reflects a combination of both the actual opiate antagonists themselves, storage containers, and then kind of ongoing maintenance.
Thank you, Ms. Bursch. Chair Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I do remember those. I just can't remember the numbers. I knew it wasn't a large amount of money, but we had no money. So that is why that money wasn't in our bill. We're not opposed to that, of course. We want to make sure that students are safe and that there's 2 doses in every residential building, residential hall available for that. I know that when the bill first was written, it was every building on campuses, and that would have been a substantial cost, but it's been narrowed now to just residential buildings. And so that's what I have to say about that. If we've got the money, I'm not opposed, but we had a zero target. So.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Chair Eric. Chair Wolgamott.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much to our testifier and to all the students who have reached out to share their stories about the importance of this provision. I want to echo what Co-Chair Rarick said. I certainly support this. It is in our health bill, so we can, talk with talk amongst ourselves here in higher ed. We can go talk to our health friends. We really want to get this done. We just want to work together and find the right place for it.
Thank you so much, Chair Wolgamott. Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you so much for coming up. Next, we have R42 through 48, the College Financing Literacy Act. which is a bipartisan bill from Senator Umu Verbein and Senator Dreheim. This language requires OHI, in close consultation with stakeholders, to develop a standardized form for colleges and universities to use for financial aid offers. This idea was based on a 2022 recommendation from the Government Accountability Office, and we've provided the full GAO report in members' packets today. There's also a similar bipartisan federal bill that's been introduced in Congress. Anyone who's ever heard, who's ever read a financial aid offer knows how confusing it can be, and the GAO found that many aid offers can be misleading or misrepresent the true cost for students and families. Standardizing aid offers will help the students plan for important financial decisions and accurately compare costs between colleges. We believe this proposal will boost enrollment and reduce the amount of debt that students take on. I believe that there's a broad coalition of support from this, like Ed Allies and the Foster Advocates. And I would like to call up again Assistant Commissioner Robinson, if that's okay, to talk to us about how OHI would implement this. Welcome, Ms. Robinson.
Hello again.
Or Commissioner Robinson.
So this language would require OHI to first do a lot of stakeholder consultation, recognizing that getting to the point we have the standardized language and have something that can be implemented in a variety of institutional types and across systems does require us to do first start with connecting with our financial aid partners on the campuses and the systems to collaborate together to create a template that would be workable for everybody and would allow for both the standardization of language, but also to allow for marketing and branding elements associated with each school to participate. And then I think the bulk of the work after the drafting would be requiring the systems and the campuses to update their letters and their form templates using their existing financial aid software systems or communications modules.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Robinson. Are there any questions from members? Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, this form would have to be used by all institutions, via education, public, private, everybody, correct?
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
As I understand it, yes.
Okay.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I bring that up is now it's obviously been a few years since I applied to college, but as somebody who applied to quite a lot of colleges, public and private, I can tell you even just that sort of difference really made a significant difference in terms of how financial aid was described to me some 20-odd years ago. And so I think as we're thinking about how we can best support students and help them to make the best decision for themselves, standardizing this in a way that is reasonable and readable for everybody sort of across institution type would be something I think would make a lot of sense. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Coulter. Are there any other questions from members? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Chair Fate. I just wondered if there was a fiscal note on this, and if you could describe the cost. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Ms. Bursch.
Chair Fate, Senator, or Representative Robbins. A fiscal note was completed on this, and there are costs estimated for the Office of Higher Education, MinState, and the University of Minnesota. It wouldn't cover the costs to private colleges just because they're not state agencies. But the largest cost is to the Office of Higher Education. It's $229,000 in the 26-27 biennium and $274,000 in the 28-29 biennium. Costs to Minnesota State are just $9,000 one time in fiscal year 2028. And then costs to the University of Minnesota are $89,000 in the 26-27 biennium and $40,000 in 28-29.
Thank you, Ms. Bursch. Ms. Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's very unusual that it's such a high number for OHI, which I know they'll have the bulk of the work, but MinState only has 9,000 2 years from now. Can you elaborate on that?
Ms. Bursch?
OHI and the
Dr. Robinson.
As I understand it from the fiscal note, the bulk of the work in terms of convening the stakeholder groups and going through that consultation process and the writing and the drafting of this will rest with OHI. Some of the additional costs that were indicated in the fiscal note for OHI are doing the auditing and compliance afterwards to make sure all the letters have been updated and they are compliant with that work. I believe the bulk of the funding requests that came from MnState were really around technological changes for them to update the letters in their systems.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Awesome. Are there any other questions or comments? Seeing none. Thank you so much, Assistant Commissioner. Are there anyone from the public that would like to come up and testify and or speak to this as well? Seeing none, we'll move on to the next portion. On R50, Disclosure of Postgraduate Outcomes. This is a bill from Senator Dreheim and Senator Utke that requires institutions to disclose information about job placement and other post-graduation information on their websites. When we heard this bill in committee, Senator Dreheim talked about his daughter and her experience balancing the pros and cons of various majors. The goal of this language is to make sure that students know what kind of jobs they might be able to get when they graduate. And I would like to call up, if possible, Mr. Oman to come speak to this as well, if he's still around. Thank you, Mr. Oman. Welcome. Would you like to speak to this bill as well?
Chair Fattah and Chair Rarick, yes, this is an initiative that was brought forward by Senator Dreheim, and it has to do with us being able to clearly represent in our websites and landing pages certain data that he felt would be helpful to students and their families. We worked with him on language on data that is already provided to, I believe it's called the Census Bureau Post-Secondary Enrollment Opportunity, which we already have that data. So from our perspective, we will just simply have that more readily available on our landing pages for students and parents to look at, which includes, not only the programs but the majors and also the expected earnings that they would have once they completed those degrees. So we're in full support, and it is not a cost on our system.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions from members? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Oman. Next up, we have R57, which is the dual training language, which is actually also house language. Would any of the other chairs like to speak to this, either Chair Wagamot or Chair Rarick? R57. Chair Rarick.
Thank you. Now I'm on the same page. I was looking at this. It had a different number. Okay, so you're talking about the dual training grant change and the employer match. Okay, so we had a bill that came forward that basically increased the amount that employers could get from the grants or use from the grants, the employees that they could use. And so in order to accommodate that, we increased also for large employers the amount that they have to contribute from 25% to 50% to kind of balance it. So that's, and it was something I think that we all agreed on, but I'll turn it over to Chair Wagamot.
Chair Wagamot.
Well said, Madam Chair. I have nothing further to add.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions from members? Seeing none, thank you both to my co-chairs. Next up, we got R75, the Permanent University Fund Modifications. This is a general fund neutral way to allocate more to the University of Minnesota's endowment into mineral research at the Natural Research Institute. And I would like to call someone from NRI. Okay, good. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you may begin.
Thank you, Chair Fattah. My name is Michael Volna. I am Vice President of Finance and Assistant Chief Financial Officer for the University of Minnesota. With respect to the proposed language, I will start out by saying the university supports this language. Supporting research on the Iron Range and providing resources for NRRI has been a priority, I think, both of some of the representatives and senators as well as university. The proposed language would not reduce the amount of money that the university receives, nor would it impose a drain on the general fund of the state. What the language would do is two things. One, it would change the distribution of the funds that come to the university. It would also increase a cap that currently applies to one of the distributions of the current funds. In total, like I say, it does not reduce the amount of money we receive. It would provide 25% of the funding that we get from the state for mineral royalties annually would now go directly to NRRI for research.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members? Seeing none, thank you so much for coming up. Lastly, we have on R79, the MinnState Go Students Enrollment Group. This is a provision from Senator Gustafson that establishes a working group to look into a new type of fraud that is largely occurring in our two-year online programs. This was a part of a number of bills in the Senate aimed at reducing fraud across all sectors. And would anyone from the audience, maybe Mr. Grant or Mr. Bone, like to come up and speak to this? Welcome, Mr. Grant. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Fatah. I'm Mark Grant. I direct the governmental relations work on behalf of Minnesota State College faculty, and I'm also a 27-year college, two-year college instructor. Yes, MSCF is in strong support of this provision. We appreciate the Senate taking a proactive approach to this. The phenomenon of ghost students in Minnesota was first detected on one of our campuses by a pretty heads-up instructor who noticed some irregularities in her enrollment. She brought it to us. We brought it to the system. I understand that the system has put together a work group and is doing really, really good work in this area. This provision would bring in all of the other constituencies, MSCF faculty, IFO, some of the folks who are on the front lines of registration, and essentially come together with some best practices and a statewide policy to address the proliferation of ghost students in our classes. So.
Thank you so much, Mr. Grant. Are there any questions from members? Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I believe this started at Century College, and I'm wondering if you could just kind of tell us the story. And like you said, there were quite a few instances of ghost students. And I'm also, so if you could kind of let us know the scope that you've uncovered. And I do have the fraud chair sitting next to me as well, so I know she's very interested in this, and we may have an entire fraud hearing about this, I think, in the future. But I'm just wondering if you could let us know the scope and really kind of how does this scam work? It'd be really helpful to understand how does that even work.
Mr. Grant.
Of course. Thank you, Co-Chair Rarick. pardon me. And I got something going on with my throat. So actually, it was initially discovered or brought to our attention at one of our technical colleges down in, I think our Riverland campus. It was an early childhood instructor who noticed a disproportionate number of men enrolled in her online asynchronous course and excited about the expanding of her appeal, but curious about the number of men who were going into early childhood. And so she started digging and realized that about a third of her online class turned out to not be real. So then she brought it to MSCF. We brought it to the system office. And that's kind of the first, at least as far as I understand, the first incident of this. Century has kind of come to the forefront in large part because they seem to be as active as any of our campuses in combating this phenomenon. So they tend to be in on the mind of anybody discussing ghost students at the two-year colleges. So we had a history instructor from Century testify to the Senate earlier this session, and they testified that one of their colleagues in a course of about 50 understood that close to half at the beginning of the session, or at the beginning of the semester, close to half were ghost students. And Century also is, I believe, currently is employing 4 full-time staff members. I believe they are routinely referred to as Ghostbusters, to combat this phenomenon on their campus. This provision in this work group hopefully will standardize some of the practices that we're seeing on all the campuses across. We just know it's a bit of a patchwork because some campuses are simply better equipped to address this. They have more time, they have more resources, they have more people. And so as far as how it actually works, and somebody from Mint State may need to rein me in on this, but if I understand it correctly, a ghost student enrolls in a course, and it seems to be, again, this is my perception, it seems to be particularly problematic at a two-year college because we're open in access institutions. It does appear as though the admissions process on a four-year university provides at least a bit of an obstacle that lazy scammers don't want to do. So open access institutions, which is the core of our two-year mission, makes us particularly attractive. They enroll typically through a stolen Social Security identity. They apply for financial aid. If they get the full load of financial aid, including the maximum loan, then within the first two weeks of the semester, after the first 2 weeks, if they are not flagged by our faculty, which are spending an enormous amount of time doing it, then the financial aid is dispersed. And any extra goes into with loans and all. There's oftentimes an overage after tuition and fees are taken care of. That overage is sent to a bank account, and my understanding is that a bank account then is immediately drained. And that's if done successfully with a significant number of students, it has the potential of being quite a bit of money. But within those first 2 weeks, our faculty are spending an enormous amount of time trying to weed out who is real and who is not. It's gotten, just in the couple of years since it was discovered on our campus, it's gotten increasingly sophisticated. As I believe our testifier testified earlier this session, the work is never good. It's never good, but it's plausible that it could, it looks a little bit like a student who could be genuinely confused or really, really struggling. So, again, as open access institutions, our core mission is to meet students where they're at and get them to where they need to be. And so some of our struggling students, apparently the work of ghost students is starting to look strikingly similar to a student who might be struggling a great deal.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you. Thank you for your work on uncovering this and clamping down on it. I really appreciate that. So I just wondered if there was a fiscal note on this, what the cost might be to form this working group. And I appreciate, you know, why you're starting with the two-year college and the open access, but I do think maybe a broader working group, depending on how it goes, might be helpful, because I think it is a problem on some four-year institutions. I think it's slightly different. In the four-year institutions, I've heard and read that a lot of times it's actual bots. It's not people signing up. And so I think that might be some of the work that also needs to be looked at.
Ms. Bursch.
Chair Fate, Representative Robbins. A fiscal note was requested on the bill as introduced, but later withdrawn when the Senate added a provision that no additional compensation will be provided for participation in the working group, and that was going to be the source of the costs.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, thank you so much, Mr. Grant, for coming up. And that will conclude our work for today. I enjoyed our discussion. Next up, Chair Walgamot will be having the gavel next week on Monday. We'll be going through some of the state grant parameter changes, the sexual misconduct policy, and other things that we couldn't today. But next up, will be your turn, Chair Wolgamott. So, and now we're adjourned.